Gospel of John, the 21st chapter. I'll give you the setting on this so that you'll know where we're coming from, knowing that you'll, if you can understand the historical and geographical setting, this will be a little more meaningful to you. The Sea of Galilee is an inland lake in northern Israel. It is approximately 13 miles long and 6 miles wide. It's 660 feet below sea level. It's bordered on the eastern shore by the Golan Heights, on the western shore by the mountains above Tiberias. To the north are the Galilean Mountains, and then into a funnel down into the Jordan Valley at the south. The Jordan River flows out of it on down towards the Dead Sea. It's in the shape of a harp. Sometimes it's referred to, the Sea of Galilee is referred to as the Sea of Kinneret in the Bible. It comes from the Hebrew word kinor, which means harp. It's in the shape of a shepherd's harp, which the Sea of Kinneret gets its name from. Surrounding it, in Jesus' name, there were a group of small villages. There was only one large city on the Sea of Galilee. It was the city of Tiberias. It's there today. It was built by King Herod over the warm springs that were there. But the Jews were never allowed into the city of Tiberias because it was Gentile territory. And so even though Herod built it there and built a synagogue in it, synagogue was never occupied. So Jesus never went into the city of Tiberias. But there were some other small villages around the city. Just north of Tiberias was the little village of Magdala, from which Mary of Magdalene or Mary of Magdala came from. To the north, there were two fishing villages. One of them was the village of Capernaum, where Simon Peter lived, and where Jesus lived during the last 3 years of his life. And the other was the little village of Bethsaida, where Philip and Andrew were from. That was inland, about a mile on a hill overlooking the Lake of Galilee or the Sea of Galilee. The text that we're looking at this morning takes place on the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee, the northeastern shore, where there was a rock beach, actually just a beach of pebbles. Looking this were the Golan Heights. There were cliffs that came down, and then there was a flat place, and then extending down to the water was this pebble beach. Following the resurrection of Jesus, his disciples, still, even though encouraged by the fact that he had resurrected, he had disappeared from them. They had all been in Jerusalem, and there had been some meetings with the risen Lord. And then he had disappeared. They didn't know where he was. And they all went back to Galilee, which is where they were from, about an 80-mile walk from Jerusalem back to Galilee. And they had walked back and had gone back to go fishing again. And early one morning, they're fishing on the Sea of Galilee, and they had fished all night long and caught nothing. And they saw this figure just at dawn standing on this pebble beach on the eastern shore of the lake. And he calls out to them, just like any observer would call out to a group of fishermen, and said, "Have you caught anything?" And they said, "No." And he said, "Well, you're fishing on the wrong side of the boat." He said, "Throw your net in on the other side." And they did that. And they tossed their net in, and it was filled with fish. And suddenly, Peter, who was in the boat, looked at this figure standing on the beach, and he said, "It's the Lord." And he leaps in the water, swims all the way to the shore. The other fellows in the boat pull their nets in, and they row to shore. And by the time they get there, why, there's a little fire burning, and they're cooking breakfast, and they had fish roasted there on the shore for breakfast. And then verse 15 picks up where I want to go this morning. This is John 21:15. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these?" And he's pointing to the other 11 men, 10 men who are standing around there. And they're sitting there finishing their breakfast meal of bread and fish. And he said, "Do you love me more than these fellows?" And he uses the word agape, which is the word for unselfish love, a kind of love that expects nothing in return. And Peter answered and said, "Yes, Lord." He said, "You know that I love you." And Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." And again Jesus said, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me?" And he answered, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And Jesus said, "Take care of my sheep." And then the third time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And he changes the verb at that particular time. Instead of using the Greek word agape, he uses the word phileo, which really means he's saying, "Peter, are you really just my friend? Are you a friend to me?" And the third time he said, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. You know that I'm your friend." And Jesus said, "Feed my sheep. I tell you the truth. When you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go." Jesus said this, and John puts this in just to explain what's happening. Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. And then he said to him, "Follow me." Now, Peter's listening to all this. Jesus has just told him he's going to die a death that he doesn't want to hear about. He's going to be taken away someplace by people that he doesn't want to take him away. Others are going to take his life from him. He's either going to be executed or murdered. And Peter's listening to all this. And verse 20, Peter turned and saw that the disciple whom Jesus loved was following them. Now, John puts a parenthesis in here because he's talking about himself. This was the one who had leaned back against Jesus at supper and said, "Lord, who is going to betray you?" And when Peter saw him, Peter turns and looks, and there's John standing there. And Peter saw him, he asked, "Lord, what about him?" Jesus had just said to Peter, you're going to die a pretty bad death. Somebody's going to take you off, and you're going to die in a way that you don't want to die. In fact, tradition says that Peter did die. He was crucified. May have been crucified upside down because he made the choice in Rome that he did not want to be crucified. He said, "I'm not worthy to be crucified the way my master was." The ancient traditions say that. And Peter somehow has some kind of inkling that this is going to happen to him. And he turns and looks at John and said, "What about him?" And Jesus answered, "If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me." There's six things I want to say to you out of this passage. They come out of my own life. They come out of the Bible. And I just want to list them. As I was going through this, the things that they suddenly, I felt that God was beginning to list some things that were for me, and I share them with you this morning at the same time. The first thing is this. When a person is following Jesus, his death glorifies God regardless of how he dies. Peter was going to be crucified. He died a martyr's death. He gave his life for Jesus. John, on the other hand, lived to be an old man, was exiled by the Roman government to the Isle of Patmos in the Mediterranean Sea, separated from all the people he loved, separated from the church he loved. But there on the Isle of Patmos, he continued to write. He wrote at least three letters that we know of back to the Christian leaders and to the churches that he had loved, that he was separated from. And then sometime before he died, and he was close to 100 years of age when he died, but sometime before he died, a natural death, he had a revelation of Jesus there on the Isle of Patmos and wrote that down, and it became the last book of the Bible, simply known as the Revelation of John, or the Revelation of Jesus to John. And it became the last book of the Bible. Peter dying a martyr's death, John dying a death of old age. And out of this passage, from what Jesus has just said to Peter, we need to stop and realize that the way or the method of a person's death is immaterial. That if a person is following Jesus, his death glorifies God regardless of how he dies. John was very specific in pointing out here about Peter's death, that Peter would glorify God with his death. Verse 19, Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Now, I realize that death is looked upon as an enemy, and it is. And we're to resist it. And yet at the same time, it's a calling. It's the one call that all of us have. It's the only way that we will make the transition from life here on earth in this flesh to life in the spirit in heaven. The only door you can go through to get there is the door of death. And for the Christian, it is not something to be feared. It is not something that we need to run from. It's not something that we continually welcome, because Jesus said we should resist it. But at the same time, when it is inevitable and when it comes, we welcome it as the transition period, moving on to the greater thing that God has for us. Peter had the privilege of dying on the cross. But at the same time, how you die, if you're following Jesus, is still a glorification to God. So whether you die of MS, or whether you die of heart disease, or whether you die of cancer, or whether you die of old age, none of these things make any difference. You're still glorifying God if you're following Jesus in the process. Now, point number two. When a person is following Jesus, not only does his death glorify God, but his life glorifies God, regardless of how long he lives or what he accomplishes in this world. It really does not make any difference whether the world calls you successful or not, because the world does not measure you the same way God measures you. It doesn't make any difference whether the world knows about you or remembers you or forgets you. All of those things are immaterial. Now, men for centuries have tried to memorialize themselves somehow to be remembered after they're gone. The Caesars had statues made of them, made of marble. If you go to Rome or to the Middle East, you'll still see those ancient statues that are there of these ancient rulers. They tried to memorialize themselves. They tried to give themselves some form of immortality. People today do that. They dedicate great buildings, hospitals, universities, have their names put on them. Streets named after them. All kinds of things. They even name their children after them. We give our children our names. We can call them Junior, Susan Junior, you know. We pass names along to our children, and all of which is all right, but the effort that is done to memorialize ourselves, it comes to absolutely nothing in God's eyes, because God does not judge us on the basis of accomplishment here on earth. God doesn't care whether the world calls you successful or whether the world remembers you or forgets you. He doesn't care what kind of job you have or how much money you make. Stephen, who was one of the early deacons, was in his late 20s or perhaps early 30s when he was drug outside the city of Jerusalem and stoned to death, executed. He did nothing to memorialize himself. The only thing he did was to give a brief testimony of Jesus that angered the religious leaders. They took him outside the city. They put him into a hole, a pit in the ground. They stood around the edge of that pit with these huge stones the size of coconuts and grapefruit, picked them up, threw them on him like this until they finally crushed him to death, until they killed him. And they did it in the name of God, preserving and defending the name of God. The only good thing that came out of that was another man who was standing there holding the coats of the executioners, a fellow by the name of Saul of Tarsus, who later became so convicted as he remembered what had happened that he opened his heart to God, and the whole Western world was evangelized because of that one man. It would not have happened had it not been for the death
of Stephen.
God didn't judge Stephen on the basis of what he accomplished on earth. He judged him by his death and the way he went out. Yesterday afternoon, Jackie and I drove down to Vero Beach. We were joined there by our son Tim and our daughter Sandy. My mother lives at the Baptist Retirement Center in Vero Beach, and my older brother Clay had flown in, and my younger sister Audrey had come in from Missouri, and we were all down there together. And my mother and dad had given the property where the Baptist Retirement Center is now located in Vero, and the Baptist had decided they were going to build a new building on the property, so they had a groundbreaking yesterday, and they wanted to honor my mother during this time, because she and my dad had given the property, and so we got her in the wheelchair and wheeled her out for this little groundbreaking ceremony, and all the Baptist officials were there, the denominational officials, and my friend Bill Lord showed up. Bill had been the director of the Florida Baptist Retirement Center for a number of years, and a dear friend, a personal friend, had taken wonderful care of my mom and of the other old folks who lived down there, and we came to know him and to love him very dearly. And last year, just about the time I had this first cancer attack, Bill had a stroke, and it's taken him a while to recover, and he's not working for the retirement center anymore. He's not able to do that. He's recovered to some degree. He was able to get up and move around and walk and use his hands, but he can't write. He's lost the ability to write, and he can't talk. He can talk just a little bit, but most of his speech faculties are gone, and he shuffles a little bit when he walks, and so he was out there. And I went over to see him and put my arm around him, and I chatted, and his wife told me a few things. Joanne was standing there, his wife, and I was aware of the fact that he was being ignored by the denominational bigwigs who were around. They were talking with the new director, and they were talking with the other people who were there, and Bill was just kind of out there on the side, and his wife said, you know. She said, we've bought a little sandwich shop downtown, and said, Bill helps me in the kitchen. And said, he helps make the sandwiches in the kitchen. And I looked at Bill, and his eyes all watered and teared up. And I thought, here he is on the grounds of this retirement center that he helped build, and all the officials are there. And he's just being ignored by everything that's going on. And now he's back in the kitchen of the little sandwich shop, putting the mayonnaise on the bread and putting the lettuce on and making the sandwiches, and he's standing there, and the tears are beginning to come down his cheeks, and I hugged him and walked away from him, and God spoke to me as I walked away and said, do you think I love Bill Lord any less because he's now working in the sandwich shop than when he was the director of the Florida Baptist Retirement Center? Said, do you think he's worth any less to me now than he was then? And then he said something very precious to me. He said, this man is worth more to me now than he ever was during all of those years when he was working with the big denomination. When a person is following Jesus, his life glorifies God, regardless of what he accomplishes here on this earth. Third thing, when a person is following Jesus, neither the accumulation of wealth or the status in community, nor the awards given, nor the length of life means anything. The only thing that counts is whether you are following Jesus. Nothing else makes any difference. Now, you can nod your heads and kind of say amen in your heart, but if you really believe that, Hold that up against the standard where you are living now. If that's the case, then why do you spend most of your time accumulating wealth or getting status in the world or doing things where you'll be rewarded or holding on to life? If you really believe that following Jesus is the most important thing, then why aren't you spending more time following Jesus? Number four. God seldom reveals His plan for our lives until the last minute. Peter was looking for a guarantee. He didn't like what Jesus told him. He didn't like these little implications that Jesus had said, somebody else is going to take your life from you. He didn't like that. What he really wanted was a guarantee of long life. We all want that. We hold on to these desires for guarantees. How desperately I wanted to hear the cancer doctor say to me this last week, cancer's gone. Never return. Your body is cancer-free. You'll never have to worry about that. You're going to live a long life. I can guarantee that you've got another 40 years, and then you're going to die a very normal, peaceful death. That's my medical guarantee to you. I wanted to walk into his office and sit down and hear him say that, and then wanted to say, Doctor, would you put that in writing and sign it so that I can hold it up to God and just show it to him every once in a while in case he has other plans for my life. But he didn't give me that. Essentially, what he told me was the only day you have that's guaranteed is this day right now. You don't have any other days besides this day. See, we want to know the future, but God seldom reveals His plan until just the last minute. I am so grateful. So very grateful that when I was in college, I didn't know what God had planned for me after I graduated. Had I known, I would have started planning. I would have taken a whole bunch of preacher courses and a lot of other things. Didn't do all that. Instead, I studied English literature and learned how to write and other things that I didn't think, what in the world you do with this? Somebody said, well, if you'll add a nickel to it, you can get a cup of coffee. Now, if you add a dollar to it, you can get a cup of coffee. What do you do with a degree in English? I didn't know what God wanted for me to do. Had no concept. I'm glad that He withheld that. He always withholds it. Now let me tell you why He withholds it. The reason He withholds it is He is more interested in building our faith than He is in getting us in the right slot. Now being in the right slot is okay. But God really doesn't care whether you're in the right slot or not. What He cares about is your faith. How close are you to Him? How much do you love Him? How much do you worship Him? How much are you following Jesus? That's the only thing that He cares about for you here on earth. He doesn't care about whether you're elected to office or defeated from office. Now, He will help you with that, but that's not the basic purpose in what God has for you. He doesn't care whether you're promoted or not promoted. Now, He will help you with that, but that's not the purpose. The reason God won't let you know the future is because He wants to build faith in you. Jim Bartholomew called me last night. Many of you know Jim. He was on staff here for several years as our youth pastor. He's at Columbia Bible College in Columbia, South Carolina right now. Working on his degree, and he called, and he just wanted to call and encourage me, and he just wanted to bless me, and he knew what we've been going through, and he just said, I just need to call and tell you how much I love you and thank you for all this church has meant to me and all that you've meant to me. And it was a uplifting kind of call. And then I said, Jim, how you doing? And he said, well, I'm doing fine. He said, my grades are good, and I've been on the dean's list for the last couple of quarters. And he says, I finished all of my classwork in Thanksgiving. And he said, I really won't graduate until June, but my classroom work will be done in Thanksgiving. He said, I don't know what I'm going to do after that. And I could catch this just little twinge of anxiety in his voice. And he said, what do you think I ought to do? Jim, I don't know. I said, that's between you. God's going to have to reveal that to you. And he said, well, God hadn't said anything to me. He said, there's been some offers to come and work in churches, and the church I'm working with here in Columbia, where my friend Glenn Anderson is the pastor, he said that they want me to stay on. And he said, is there anything going to be open at the Tabernacle? And I said, Jim, I don't know. I don't know what tomorrow's going to hold. I don't know how long I'm going to be here. I don't know how long the church is going to be here. I don't know how long Jesus is going to tarry before he comes back again. I don't know. The future is withheld from me. I said, the only thing I know to do is you're going to have to walk this one out by faith. But I'll tell you this, God will tell you before deadline time. Usually about 30 seconds. And then I reminded him of something that I wrote years ago for my old friend Corrie ten Boom. Corrie ten Boom, you know, her father, they had lived in Harlem, in Holland, the original Harlem, the one you can still drive into. But they lived in Harlem, in Holland, and her family during World War II had protected the Jews there in Harlem and had hidden them in their house, and the Nazis had found them, and the Gestapo had come and had arrested the whole family, put them all in a concentration camp, and her father and her sister died in the concentration camp, and Corrie almost died, and then she came out, and God used her in a mighty way. And I wrote this little book for her called Tramp for the Lord, which was a sequel to her earlier book called The Hiding Place. And I said, Jim, let me remind you a story of Corrie ten Boom. And this morning, I got up early and went down to my study and took the book off the shelf. I forget, 1974, that's when I wrote this thing. And found the story. And Corrie says, when I was a little girl, I went to my father and said, Daddy, I'm afraid that I will never be strong enough to be a martyr for Jesus Christ. Tell me, Father said, when you take a train trip from Harlem to Amsterdam, when do I give you the money for the ticket? 3 weeks before? No, Daddy. You give me the money for the ticket just before we get on the train. That's right, Father said. And so it is with God's strength. Our wise Father in heaven knows when you're going to need things, too. Today, you do not need the strength to be a martyr. But as soon as you're called upon for the honor of facing death for Jesus, He will supply the strength you need just in time. And so it is with God. He doesn't reveal the future to us. Instead, he wants us to build faith on the inside. Not anxiety, not fear, but faith to believe that He will give us what we need at the proper time. Number five. God's ways are never our ways. God's ways are never our ways. But they are always good ways. Recently, somebody wrote me a card. Individual may be here this morning. And he said, I've listened to your sermons since I moved to Florida. I've lost everything family, possessions, even some health since living in Florida. No matter how tough life seemed, I would get strength from the Lord through His Word and through the praise and worship service at the Tab. Today, however, I left the service so weak and depressed. I thought my enemies were boiling, wringing me out and hurting me. Today you tell me God is good, and yet I see sinners prosper, enjoy good health, and have families that love them. Why is God so good to them? And why does He punish the believer? You know, I think had I gotten this card 20 years ago, I could have given answers to this person. One of the things that happens as you grow older and get closer to God is you know less and believe more. I don't have any answers for this. He has asked questions that I don't have answers for. Why is God good to the wicked? And why does He punish the believer? Or seem to punish the believer? Now, I can quote all kinds of scriptures. Lots of scriptures come to mind with this. 73rd Psalm is written to answer this kind of question. The best I can really come up with is to simply say, I don't know. I don't know why some people are rich and some people aren't. I don't know why some people are sick and others aren't. I don't know why I've got some cancer cells in my body and others don't have cancer cells. I walk down the street and look at people who have abused their body and cursed and blasphemed God. And they're walking healthy and free, and I don't understand that. I don't understand it. I have served Him the best I could most of my life. I've taken care of my body. I don't smoke. I don't drink. I watch what I eat. I've tried to exercise. I do everything right, and then there's something in there that I don't want. And I don't understand that. I don't understand why some babies are born deformed. I don't understand Down syndrome. I don't understand babies that die early, catch diseases and die or are killed. I don't understand. There's a whole lot of things I don't understand. I used to have answers to those things. I don't know. But I believe. I don't walk by sight anymore. I started walking by faith. And it really doesn't make any difference, because life is not that long anyway. Back to Stephen. Late 20s, maybe early 30s when he's killed. How does he feel about that? John gets to live to be 100. Stephen's wiped out at 27. Doesn't seem fair. It's not fair. Doesn't seem just. It's not just. But God's ways are not our ways. But they are always good ways. Because He sees it from His side rather than from ours. And I think, how does Stephen feel about it? How does he feel about it now? 2,000 years later, looking back on it, he probably can't even remember it because it only lasted that long. That's how long life was. We need to start looking at life from eternity's perspective. And that's the only answer I can give. to this. And whether I understand or not is immaterial. I will praise him nevertheless. And so when the doctor came in the other day and told me, he said, you've got a good report on the CAT scan. The tumor's receding and parts of it have disappeared. Jackie and I got quiet for a minute and pulled aside and thanked the Lord. And then both of us said, but Father, bring us to the place to where we can thank you regardless of the news that is given. Regardless of the circumstances, that we will praise you in the midst of it. Now finally, and one more thing, and I'll close with this. Peter was learning this. There is a difference in praying and wishing. Last week, we were driving over to the medical center in St. Pete from the doctor's home where we were staying. It was on Tuesday. We were going in for the CAT scan that morning. Jackie and I were praying in the car as we drove over out loud, praying that the CAT scan would show progress and that the tumor is dying, and praying that when they looked in there that we would see good things. And suddenly I realized, this isn't a prayer. This is a wish. It's not really a prayer. We're just wishing good things. We're hoping for good things. But that's not praying. Now, God understands that. God puts the desire for good things in our hearts, and he says he will give us the desires of our hearts. And so it's okay to wish. I'm not condemning you for that. But I am saying to you, that's not prayer. Jackie is right, and she reminded me of this. She says there's only one kind of legitimate prayer. The only kind of legitimate prayer is to find out what Jesus is praying. Who is our intercessor? The scriptures say he sits on the right hand of God interceding for us. To find out what Jesus is praying and to pray with him. Be in agreement with him. And when we are in agreement with him, we are praying a prayer that will always be answered. You say, well, maybe Jesus isn't praying the kind of prayer I'd like for him to pray. Chances are he's not. Because his ways are not our ways. But as you look here in John 21, you find out that Jesus has the power over life and death. And Jesus says to Peter, if I want John to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? I have the power to determine who will live and who will not live and how long they will live, because I see the overall plan. Now, he didn't have that 30 days before. He had given that up when he came to earth, but now he's in a glorified body and he sees things an awful lot different. Now he's seeing things with the Father's eyes, and he says, I have the power to say that a man will live to be 100 and the other power to say that a man will live to be 20. Don't worry about that. Follow me. Follow me. And so praying in agreement is praying a prayer that will always be answered. James says that the reason your prayers aren't answered is because you're praying amiss. What's he mean by that? He means you're wishing instead of praying. Most of our prayers are wishes. They're not Jesus' prayers. And so the only way to stay with Jesus, well, how do we follow him? We follow him by getting to know him. And the only way to get to know him, the only way to get to know him is through this book. Now, you can do it in prayer, but if you don't have this book, you'll not know him. You'll know a false Jesus. You have got to get into the Gospels. You've got to get into his life and find out who he is, and then you'll be able to understand his personality and to pray the way he prayed. That's the only way you'll be able to follow him. So I want to encourage you this morning. Get to know him. And after you've gotten to know him, commit yourself to follow him. Let's stand together. Get quiet for a minute, please. I'm getting ready to leave. With your eyes closed, Let me put you into the realm of imagination. And where you're standing there, I want you to see a bright light right over your head, shining straight down like a spotlight. And it is so bright that you can't see outside of the light. The light encircles you like a cylinder. And you're standing in the middle of that. And the light blocks out everything else on the outside. Blocks out your wife or husband that you're with this morning. Blocks out your child. Blocks out your friend that you're seated beside. It's just you and Jesus inside of that light. And everything else is gone. Now, I want to challenge you to make a commitment to Jesus right where you are. And will you say to him, I will follow you. And will you say to him, I will praise you. And will you say to him, I will trust you. Now let me go back over those because I want you to say them not out loud but in your heart as you're standing there with Jesus. And say it as a vow to him. I will follow you. I will praise you. I will trust you. And then go one step beyond before you walk out of the light and out into this day. Would you also say to him, I want to know you better. Help me to study your word so that I can know you. Father, we wipe away everything else now to believe that we're put here on this earth to worship you and to enjoy your presence and for you to enjoy us and take pleasure in us. Tune our hearts to your Son, Jesus. Amen.